This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war on terrorism has led to new security measures, like the Patriot Act and the Total Information Awareness Program. Do these new measures risk compromising our freedom of speech, our privacy, and our rights to associate with whom we please? Today we'll hear from constitutional lawyers on each side of that question. David Cole is the co-author of Terrorism and the Constitution, Sacrificing Civil Liberties in the Name of National Security. He's a volunteer staff attorney for the Center for Constitutional Rights and has litigated terrorism-related cases since the late 80s. He's also a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and is the legal affairs correspondent for The Nation. Let's start with the new Defense Department program, Total Information Awareness.
Well, this is really a quite remarkable project of the military to essentially create a data mining mechanism that would be able to go out and retrieve from all of the sources on computers and the web worldwide all the information about any U.S. citizen or indeed any person that is contained therein. So, you know, when you buy something with your credit card, when you make a phone call, when you search the web, when you take a book out of the library, all that information is stored in some computer file. And what the military is proposing to do with Total Information Awareness is to give the military the ability to pull up all that information on any given individual at any time.
Does the government require any kind of warrant, any kind of special power to do the type of Total Information Awareness electronic profiling that it wants to do?
Well, for the most part, no, because the Supreme Court has said that any information that we share with a third party is no longer private, and therefore the Fourth Amendment, which generally prohibits the government from intruding on our privacy without probable cause of a crime, does not apply. So the government already can get your bank records, your school records, your video store rental records, your credit card records, and the like, without having to comply with the Fourth Amendment. However, there have been statutory laws enacted that are designed to protect this information from sort of willy-nilly snooping from the government. And the proposal for Total Information Awareness would include loosening those restrictions on the government from getting access to the information.
So what are you afraid might happen if this goes into effect?
Well, I think there's really two problems. One is, do we want the government to be able to have access to essentially every piece of information about our daily lives that we have to share with another person in order to accomplish, our daily activities? Yes, we have to let the phone company know what phone numbers we're dialing, and yes, we have to let the email provider know what who we're sending emails to, but do we want that the government to have that information? Do we trust the government to use that information appropriately? And secondly, do we trust the military to have that information? And I think our history has shown that when the government engages in broad-based spying and information collection without a specific tie to criminal activity, it is very likely to engage in essentially political spying, spying on people who express views in opposition to the government in power. And, you know, it was a central practice of the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and, you know, ultimately led to Richard Nixon spying on the Democratic Party in the Watergate case.
Total Information Awareness is headed by John Poindexter, who's also considered to be the father of the concept. He was convicted of 5 felony counts during the Iran-Contra affair. What was he convicted of?
He was convicted of lying to Congress about the government's efforts to avoid explicit restrictions that Congress had provided on providing aid to the Contras. And his convictions were overturned not because he was innocent, but simply because the courts found that Congress had given him immunity in requiring him to testify about his wrongs before them, and therefore he couldn't be prosecuted for those wrongs.
What do you think of Poindexter as the choice to head Total Information Awareness?
Well, I think if you wanted to create a program that would generate widespread public concern, you would call it Total Information Awareness. You'd create a logo that says knowledge is power, and you'd put John Poindexter at the head of it. I mean, I think this is a program that's sort of doomed to failure from the beginning, simply as a PR matter.
Well, you'd prefer not that the program fail, but that it not start at all. What are you trying to do to prevent Total Information Awareness from going any further?
Well, I think the most important thing is to give people information about Total Information Awareness, because I think if the public is made aware of a program like this, in which the military is going to be able to get access to their everyday lives in a routine manner, I think the public will stop it. I mean, we've seen that in the wake of September 11th. The government proposed a program called Operation TIPS, which would involve recruiting some 11 million U.S. citizens essentially to spy on each other, to spy on their neighbors, and to report that information to the FBI and to the Justice Department. When word of that program got out, like with Total Information Awareness, there was a substantial outcry from voices on the right as well as on the left. And in the Homeland Security bill, Dick Armey made sure that there was a provision that prohibited any spending of money on Operation TIPS. So, and I would predict that Total Information Awareness will see the same fate. That is, it will die politically because it so greatly intrudes on so many people's lives, potentially, that there will be a political groundswell against it.
David Cole is my guest. He's co-author of the book Terrorism and the Constitution. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and specializes in civil liberties and terrorism law. We've been talking about some of the changes in the law since September 11th. Let's look historically a little bit. What are some of the ways, for better and for worse, the United States has reacted to threats against us in the past? Let's start with World War I and World War II. Are there ways that the FBI or that intelligence has acted in response to World War I or World War II that's instructive to look at now?
Certainly. I think, in fact, what you see when you look at our history is that in every time of fear, of broad-based fear, and usually it's war, but not always, government reacts by taking broad-based measures, short-circuiting procedures that are designed to distinguish the innocent from the guilty, and relying on kind of broad prophylactic measures to ultimately harm many, many innocent people. In World War I, for example, we made it a crime for anyone to merely speak out against the war. 2,000 people were prosecuted under this law. 1,000 were convicted and sentenced. One of them was Eugene Debs, who was actually the Socialist Party candidate for president. He ran for president from prison and earned 1 million votes. But he was serving a 10-year sentence for doing nothing more than making a speech in which he praised certain individuals who had resisted the draft. In World War II, we interned 110,000 people on the West Coast simply for their ethnic background, their Japanese ancestry. 70,000 of them were U.S. citizens, but they were of Japanese descent. The other 40,000 were Japanese citizens. And the military argued that, you know, you can't distinguish. You have to assume they're all going to be loyal to Japan, even though the vast majority of them were U.S. citizens, and interned them all, from elderly grandmothers to young children. So we've made some pretty bad mistakes, and I think in retrospect, we recognize those as mistakes.
I'm going to ask you about another war, the Vietnam War. Ways we reacted to that give you concern.
Well, to sort of see the Vietnam War era, you actually have to look at it in the context of the Cold War, because really many of the measures that were applied in the Vietnam War began in the Cold War through the FBI in particular targeted at communists and those who were thought to be associated with communists. Even, you know, association with communists could even be, you know, your father was a communist and you were influenced by your father. Therefore, we're suspicious of you. We'll put you through a loyalty review program if you're in the federal government. We'll call you before HUAC. If the committee decides, the FBI will create a file on you. Well, in the Vietnam War era, those measures, which were initially targeted at communists, were extended to include women's rights groups, civil rights groups, the peace movement, a very broad range of groups, so that the FBI was spying on people like Martin Luther King and gathering information about people's private lives, sending informants into organizations that the FBI was suspicious of, with the specific purpose of not just of reporting on what those organizations were doing, but actually disrupting those organizations. They did things like dropped what they called snitch jackets on leaders of radical or progressive groups. Snitch jackets were false documents that were designed to lead people within the group to suspect that the leader was in fact an FBI informant. They also wrote anonymous letters to the wives of some of the leaders, accusing them of adultery, of having affairs and the like. They announced that meetings and demonstrations had been canceled, that in fact had not been canceled. And they really went very, very far. And I think if you look historically, you see that the FBI initially adopted these measures out of a legitimate concern that there was likely to be sabotage, spying at the behest of the Soviet Union in the United States. But ultimately, the program grew and grew and grew to where it was essentially monitoring the political activities of everyday liberals.
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Cole. He's co-author of the new book, Terrorism and the Constitution. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center, a volunteer staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and legal affairs correspondent for The Nation. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Cole. He's the co-author of the book Terrorism and the Constitution. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a volunteer staff attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Well, we talked a little bit about some of your historic concerns. Let's get back to the present. The Homeland Security Act was passed with the hopes of having America's security and defense agencies communicate with each other more effectively and efficiently. Why don't you discuss what you perceive to be the main facets of this act?
Well, I think the goal behind the act is a good one. One of the concerns that has been identified after September 11th is that we have in the federal government many entities that engage in law enforcement that is related in one way or another to terrorism and to the threats of terrorism, from customs to the FBI to the CIA to the DEA to the Federal Emergency Management Association to the Coast Guard. And there's just to FAA. There's just a wide variety of groups, and they weren't talking to each other. They weren't sharing information. Probably the most egregious example was that the CIA had identified dangerous terrorist individuals and had not provided that list to the State Department, which decides on whether to issue a visa to any given individual who wants to come to the United States. So here one part of the government knew who the dangerous people were, but it was not providing that information to the other part of the government, which was deciding who we should allow into the country and who we should keep out of the country. I mean, that's crazy.
From your point of view, do you think that John Ashcroft and Congress have good intentions in creating this, that their number one goal is stopping terrorism? Or do you think that some or all of them have ulterior motives in creating these new security bureaucracies and new security laws?
At this point, I don't see evidence that those in the Justice Department and in Congress who are putting these new laws in place have an ulterior motive. I think they want to protect us. They feel like they should be given as broad powers as possible in order to do so. And I've been on countless panels with government officials who essentially say, trust us. You know, yes, these powers are very broad. Yes, we can now lock up, you know, aliens without giving them any hearing whatsoever. Yes, we're trying people in secret. Yes, we can get warrants to search your home and to wiretap your phones without probable cause of crime. But trust us, we will only use it in good faith. And, you know, my response is that has never been a particularly useful way to organize a government. That has never been the theory of American government. The theory of our government has been that we want a rule of laws, not a rule of men or of persons, that we're not willing to simply give government unfettered power and then trust them to exercise it wisely, because what we have seen in the past is that when people exercise power, they enjoy exercising that power, and they are very likely to overstep their bounds in the exercise of that power, even when they're acting out of the best intentions.
You've been doing litigation pertaining to terrorism since about 1987, years before September 11th. I'd like you to choose a recent or an earlier case that you've handled that you think really represents the type of problem you're concerned about now.
Well, it's hard to choose because there have been so many, but I'll just take one, and that's a man named Mazen Al-Najjar, who was an adjunct professor at the University of South Florida, a Palestinian, who before September 11th, spent 3.5 years in immigration detention on the basis of secret evidence that he nor his attorneys, of which I was one, were ever able to see. He was told, the only thing he was told about this information was that it showed that he was associated with the Palestine Islamic Jihad, an Islamic fundamentalist group in the West Bank and the occupied territories of Israel. And that's all he was told. He wasn't told how he was alleged to be associated, who said he was associated, when he was associated, what he was alleged to have done. But without knowing anything further, he was unable to defend himself. He denied that he was a member. He had people testify that he wasn't, but he was locked up for 3.5 years on the basis of secret evidence before September 11th. We then sued in federal court and got a court to rule that it's unconstitutional to lock a human being up without affording him an opportunity to confront the evidence against him. A new trial was ordered. At the conclusion of the trial, the judge ruled that there was absolutely no evidence to suggest that Mazen Al-Najjar was connected to the Palestine Islamic Jihad, that he had ever supported the Palestine Islamic Jihad, that he had ever advocated or engaged in any kind of terrorist activity, and he ordered his release. He was released in December of 2000. Then September 11th happens, and in November of 2001, he's arrested again, and the government simply repeats the charges that it had that were disproved in the trial a year earlier, does not say that there's any new evidence, says in a public statement that he's not connected with September 11th, but their detention of him shows that they're going to be tough on the war on terrorism. He was put into solitary confinement, and he had very, very restricted phone calls, very restricted visits to his family. This is a person who was never charged with, much less convicted of, even a petty crime. And yet he was being locked up under conditions far worse than we incarcerate most murderers, most convicted murderers.
What was the outcome?
Ultimately, he was deported to a third country that is he doesn't want to be named for fear of reprisals. But he was deported for having overstayed his visa. But here's a person who spent 4.5 years in detention, who has never, ever been charged with a crime, and the only allegation against him was an allegation of political association. I think what that illustrates is both a number of things. One, the government is very likely in the war on terrorism to engage in kind of broad brush guilt by association, not to target people who are actually engaged in criminal activity, but to go after people on mere charges of association. Two, that it is likely to avoid the protections of the criminal process, where you could never lock a person up on the basis of secret evidence, and instead exploit administrative processes that allow it to avoid some of the safeguards that we associate with a fair public trial, the right to confront the evidence used against you. And three, that it is likely to focus these kinds of measures on the most vulnerable, on, in particular, Arab and Muslim non-citizens, people who don't have the same kind of ability to recourse to the courts, don't have the sort of popular support that other immigrants and certainly citizens might have were the government to target them.
David Cole, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Cole is the co-author of Terrorism and the Constitution. He's a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and is legal correspondent for The Nation. We'll hear from a constitutional expert who supports the new anti-terrorism security measures in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.